So as we continue on our study through the revelation of Jesus Christ, do a real short review in the last couple slides that we went over. We read Revelation chapter 1, 12 through 16 last week, and we looked at a description of Jesus, or the Son of Man, as he gave himself a title. Talked about the robe that reached his feet, the hair like wool, like snow, his eyes like a flame of fire, his feet were like burnished bronze, they're finished bronze. His voice was like the sound of many waters. The sword came out of his mouth, and his face was shining bright like a sun. It's a picture of his glory, okay? And we went on and looked at some Old Testament references, and we can kind of see, as I mentioned, we see pieces of the picture we see that John describes in Revelation 1 there, we see pieces of that in the Old Testament throughout. We referenced Isaiah 6, where he saw the glory of the Lord, the lofty throne, the robe that fills the temple, the cherubim or the seraphim that had six wings that are around him. We referenced last week, Isaiah saw this, he says, and we read John 12 today in the sermon, but Isaiah saw that and he saw his glory. He saw Jesus on the throne, and we pointed out that that Jesus is in fact Yahweh. He was the one who was on the throne. We looked at Isaiah and Jeremiah last week, referencing the branch. And we looked at Zechariah, where Joshua, the Hebrew is Yeshua, and the Greek translated would be Jesus. So the Yeshua, and that's where some real legalist people don't even use the word Jesus. They use Yeshua Messiah. Because that's they have to say it in the Hebrew language, I guess, whatever. But that's the crossover there. But he is a symbol, it says in Zechariah, that they were symbols. The people who were with him were symbols. The God is telling Joshua that. And so Joshua is a symbol of the branch there, because Joshua was the high priest. And we won't get to it today, but we mentioned that in chapter 6 that there was he took his seat, the high priest was on the throne, and that was a picture of Jesus being priest on the throne. And then we see Zerubbabel, he was a symbol of building the temple, just as Jesus is. And then we also reference the eyes in chapter 3, verse 9. The eyes are the eyes of the Lord that go to and fro. Okay, so those are some pictures as we continue to go on here, continue to go on in these other Old Testament passages, and we'll see this picture of Jesus, but we see this picture brought out in the revelation of Jesus Christ talking and about him, and John is describing that. And let's go to today then. We'll start off with any comments or something on, before we guess we go there, on the review there. Okay, so let's go to Ezekiel chapter 1. Ezekiel chapter 1. And again, this isn't the last time that we're going to be referencing Old Testament passages or prophecy as we're studying through this, because there's a lot of things that in the book that we're going to have to reference back to. And we might not get to every single detail of Old Testament writing that talks about. We're going to get to hit quite a bit of it, though, throughout our study. But Ezekiel here is one. It's a pretty detailed picture, a pretty lengthy read here, I guess. But in Ezekiel chapter 1, 4 through 14, if somebody would like to read that, please.
As I looked, behold, a storm wind was coming from the north, a great cloud with fire flashing forth continually, and a bright light around it, and in its midst something like glowing metal in the midst of a fire. Within it were the figures resembling four living beings, and this was their appearance. They had human form. Each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, and their feet were like a calf's hoof, and they gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, were human hands. As for the faces and wings of the four of them, their wings touched one another. Their faces did not turn when they moved. Each went straight forward. As for the form of their faces, each had the face of a man. All four had the face of a lion on the right and the face of a bull on the left. And all four had the face of an eagle. Such were the faces. Their wings were spread out above. Each had two touching another being and two covering their bodies. And each went straight forward, wherever the Spirit was about to go, they would go, without turning as they went. In the midst of the living beings, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches darting back and forth among the living beings. The fire was bright, and lightning was flashing from the fire. And the living beings ran to and fro like bolts of lightning.
Yeah. So we see this picture, and when we get into chapter 4 and 5, we're probably going to reference back to Ezekiel here again when we talk about the living beings. But specifically, we want to look at the living beings move where the Spirit moved. Okay, and you see that some of that picture in there. The Hebrew word for verse 13, that's the torches. Okay, it says that there was something that looked like a torch darting back and forth amongst living beings. So you have the four living beings, and you have this torch that goes back and forth. That's the same Hebrew word as in Genesis 15, verse 17, when Abraham took all the animals and he split them in half and had them lay out, and it said there was a torch. When darkness came upon the land, it was a torch that split the offering, it says. And so that torch, if you go back and read that context, is undoubtedly Yahweh. Okay, or God Almighty. And so this picture here, we're seeing in Ezekiel, and we're going to see that as we continue reading in Ezekiel here, but we see this torch that's surrounded by the living beings, okay? These living beings are, as we're going to see continuing our study, is that this cherubim or these angels that surround the throne, these band of mighty angels, and it surrounds the throne of God, and the throne moves. Wherever they move, wherever the Spirit moves, they move. Now, we'll want to make sure, and we'll probably reference this again, it's not that God needs protection from someone. It's this picture of this king that's on the throne, and he has this band of mighty angels, and they're ready to go forth and conquer for his purpose. And we'll continue to see this here. Let's continue in verse 15 of Ezekiel chapter 1, 15 through 21, please, if someone would like to read that.
Then I looked. Same likeness, their appearance and workmanship being as if one wheel were within another. Whenever they went in any of their four directions without turning as they went. And as for their rims, they were lofty and awesome, and the rims of all four of them were full of eyes all around. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures rose from the earth, the wheels rose also. Wherever the Spirit was about to go, they would go in that direction. Wherever the Spirit was about to go and the wheels rose alongside of them, for the Spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Whenever those went, they went, and wherever those stood still, these stood still. And wherever those rose from the earth, the wheels rose close beside them, for the Spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels.
Okay, so we see these wheels are lofty. And we know this torch here is used in other places in Scripture in Genesis 15 that is talking about God Almighty. Okay, so you see this fire and this power. When we looked in the introduction, we were kind of introduced to Book of Revelation, we talked about like lightning and thunder and earthquakes and that description of that power of the Lord. And we see some of that here, that fire, that lightning. And we see that God is surrounded by the living beings, but the wheels are lofty and they're full of eyes. Remember Zechariah, we talked last week, Zechariah wrote that the eyes of the Lord to and fro. Now, we have some references of that in the Revelation of Jesus Christ. We talk about the Spirit with seven eyes, or the seven spirits, but the Lamb with seven eyes. And that idea there is tying these pictures of God Almighty in the Old Testament with Jesus in the New Testament. That this is who the Old Testament writers had this picture, and they had parts of this picture. But and it's important that we read the Old Testament for that purpose, because Jesus even references when he talks to the churches, he'll address the churches, each of those seven. He references stuff that John didn't even reference. He says the one who has the eyes of the Lord, or the one who has the key of David. Okay, he references Old Testament passages, and so it's important to know, as we mentioned last week, the Old Testament is concealed, but it's important to know it's revealed by the New Testament, but the New Testament doesn't stand alone either, because there's a lot of references in the Old Testament that Jesus is communicating to the church here that this is who is talking to you. I understand what you're going to go through and what you've gone through and what you're about to go through. As we're going to see the letters of the churches, there's different things that he tells them, each one of them. And so communicating to the church as a whole there is that he is saying, I am the one who has, if we read this here, the eyes that go to and fro. There's nothing that happens on earth that I don't see. And so if we're understanding that and we know that he is that capable, then as for the wicked, that's terrifying. But for the saint, that is that we can take courage, because God knows. It's not up to us to make sure they get their due justice. Okay? It's for us to preach the gospel, and hopefully they repent. But we need to know that God has gone through what we have gone through, and he knows exactly what happens. Continuing in verse 22 through 28, if somebody would like to read that, of Ezekiel chapter 1.
Now over the heads of the living beings there was something like an example, like the awesome gleam of crystal extended over their heads. And under their expansion, their wings were stretched out straight, one towards the other. Each one also had two wings covering their bodies on one side and the other.
To what?
28, please. 28.
I also heard the sound of their wings like the sound of abundant waters as they went, like the voice of the Almighty, and sound of tumult, like the sound of an army camp. Whenever they stood still, they dropped their wings, and there came a voice from above the expansion that was over their heads. Whenever they stood still, they dropped their wings, and above the expansion that was over their heads, there was something resembling a throne like lapis and lazuli in appearance, and that which resembled a throne high up was a figure with the appearance of a man. Then I noticed from the appearance of his loins and upward something like glowing metal that looked like fire all around within it. From the appearance of his loins and downward, I saw something like fire, and there was a radiance around him, as the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face and heard a voice speaking.
Okay, so a couple things there as we're in that passage there. Notice in verse 24, it says, the voice of the Almighty is like the sound of many waters. Okay, so when John is describing him in Revelation chapter 1, he says his voice was like the sound of many waters. And yes, in this particular verse, it's talking about the wings, but it references the wings were like the voice of the Almighty. Okay, so yeah, the wings are like the sound of many waters, but the voice of the Almighty also was. It's like the sound of many waters, and the idea of that power. You know, when you hear a rapid rushing river, it's just that sound of power running there. And again, that's that picture. And granted, as we mentioned last week too, John and Ezekiel and Isaiah and Zechariah, they're giving pictures as best as they can describe it with the physical things on earth. And so when we think of a sound like a mighty rushing water, it means it's like that. It doesn't mean it's exactly it. It's more powerful and great. That the appearance is better than the rainbow. Okay, that glory that God has is going to be more awesome than the rainbow there. And so that's the idea there, is they're given pictures that we can relate to, but that it doesn't do it justice, but it still is a picture. Now, notice it says in verse 26 is that the throne of the Lord is described there. Okay, it has a throne, but it says a man sat on the throne. Now, a point of that is that Jesus many times is referred to as the Son of Man. Or you could look at it another way too, is that in John, when he gives the example of, you know, have we seen the Father? Philip asked, and he said, well, you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Jesus is God in the flesh. So when it says a man sat on it, a physical man, a man who is human, is not worthy to sit on the throne of Christ by themselves. So the man that Ezekiel is describing, even though he doesn't describe it in detail, he said there's appearance of a man, is undoubtedly talking about Jesus, because he is the one who became flesh. He is the flesh of God, God in the flesh, okay? And his appearance is like fire, and his feet were like fire. Again, that picture that John gives us in Revelation as well. And then Ezekiel fell on his face because of the glory of the Lord. So you have Isaiah saying, I'm a dead man because I've seen the glory of the Lord. Ezekiel is falling on his face because he sees the glory of the Lord. So just remember that here a second. But is there anything before we continue on that, on Ezekiel? Any questions or comments?
Moses had to be shielded.
Right. Lord, so the indication is pretty bright.
Right.
It kind of melts you.
Yeah.
Kel's always telling about the solar farm down there in Las Vegas, where they have the mirror that reflects solar into the rays into the solar deal. Mm-hmm. You have a bird flies through, it just fries them. That's probably
a similar picture
you get of that deal.
Yeah. So. And that glory there is that, so you can tell the difference of the of who you're talking about or who it's being described when he does that. You know, is that he fell on his face. That idea there is that the glory of the Lord, like you mentioned, is consuming, and you know, for those who don't have the indwelling spirit, it's definitely consuming. You know, because that's what the wicked are going to be like. Hide us from the wrath of the Lamb. You know, because that glory, His glory, is going to be terrifying to them because they haven't been obedient. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. Another picture of the throne here as well. Verse 9 and 10, if somebody would like to read that, please.
I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames, its wheels were green fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were open.
Okay, so we see a picture here of the Ancient of Days sitting on the throne. Okay, and we see his clothing is white and or bright. His hair is like wool. Remember, John is given this description of Jesus. In Revelation chapter 1, he's saying his clothing was bright, his hair was white like wool, like white snow. His throne was a fire. The throne had wheels of fire. Okay, we referenced back in Ezekiel there that there are wheels that surrounded the throne of God where that torch was. This picture that these are overlapping or tying together and coming into a complete picture, I guess, being described as Jesus being described as fulfilling all of this. In Revelation 1:17, let's turn it back up to there. Revelation 1:17. Again, we're going to go back to Ezekiel. We're going to go back to Daniel, Zechariah, other places in the Old Testament as we continue the study. Not today, but as we continue the study there. But remember what Ezekiel did when he saw the glory of the Lord. In verse 17 of Revelation chapter 1, John, after describing this here, Christ, he says, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as like a dead man, and he placed his right hand upon me, saying, 'Do not be afraid, I'm the first and the last.'" So when John fell on his face, when he saw the glory, so you think about, a lot of people reference Jesus' glory as after he resurrected, before he ascended, and they saw the glory, they'll say. The thing is that there was no difference in how the apostles, yeah, I mean, when they saw him appear in their midst, they were thinking, "Oh man, what's happened here?" They were fear gripped him, because it's like, that doesn't happen. But didn't fear grip him when they were on the boat, when they saw him walking on water? I mean, so that was the same. Like, that's not the same as seeing the glory, because they were able to interact with him before and after his resurrection. They could talk with him. He could eat, and he proved that he wasn't a ghost by eating. But after he ascended, so John, who wrote the Gospel of John, he writes about talking with him after he resurrected. Here, when he writes the Revelation of Jesus Christ, when he sees him here, this vision, he sees him and he falls on his face like Ezekiel did. Like Isaiah is like, "Man, I'm a dead man because I've seen the glory of the Lord." That the glory is so awesome that it was different than him being on earth. And so this picture here, again, as we kind of tried to hammer home, is that this is Jesus fulfilling all of the Old Testament writings about the throne room of God in this passage here. And then even as we continue, we're going to see more of that as we go. Jesus said he's the first and the last. And when we talked about that, let's turn there to Revelation chapter 22. We did mention this before. We'll just tie this up again here. He says he's the first and the last. So Revelation 22, verse 12 and 13, if somebody would like to read that, please.
"Behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me, to render to every man according to what he has done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end."
Okay, as we referenced before there, you know, there are some that teach that Jesus is a created angel, but he himself is saying that I'm the first and the last, and he references here, "I'm the first and the last, the Alpha and the Omega," which is the first letters of the Greek and Greek alphabet, first and last letters, that idea of the beginning and the end. Okay, and then he goes back in chapter 1, verse 8, he says, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty." And we referenced before that in Ezekiel, it says the voice of the Almighty was like a sound of many waters. Okay, well, Jesus' voice is like the sound of many waters. Okay, the idea of the Ancient of Days in Daniel chapter 7 is the hair like white wool and the wheels on fire, which gives that the same description in Ezekiel. And it's fitting this description here that John is giving about Jesus or the glorified Christ. So this is a picture of the glorified Christ on his throne when he is speaking to John. And so John, prior to, as we mentioned, before he ascended, interacted with him. But here, and yeah, he's talking back and forth with him, but the idea is that he was terrified because he fell at his feet, on his face, when he saw his glory. So this is a picture of Jesus glorified. And so as we're going on here then, it's going to be an encouragement for the church to understand who this actually is that is talking. He's referencing things in the Old Testament of who he is and reminding them of what he has accomplished. Anybody have any comments or anything on that before we move on? So Revelation chapter 1, verse 18, if somebody would like to read that, please.
"And the living one and I was dead, and the living one and I was dead, and behold, I am alive forever, and I have the keys of death
Okay. So this is kind of some thought I was having as we were going through, as I was studying through this, is that it seems that Jesus is reminding the church exactly what he's accomplished and who he is for a specific purpose. Now, this is going back to, as we're kind of at the end of the study today, is it's going to go back to the purpose of the book and who it's written to and who's the beneficiary of it. Because there are people that teach that it was only first century. There are people who teach that it's still only the future. And as we're going to see, is that this is a book that applies to those who are in the first century, and it applies to people, the church during the Dark Ages. It applies to the church now, and it applies to the church in the future. Okay? And so we need to understand that Jesus is reminding the church of something. Turn to Hebrews chapter 4 real fast here. Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14 through 16, please.
Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need.
Okay, so Christ, as high priest, can sympathize with us. So see, if he's reminding the church of his accomplishments and what he has done for her, then he is one who can sympathize with her when she is going through the trials that's going to happen. To the churches and the seven churches here, yes, but also to the church as a whole as well. Jesus knows what the church, them and us, has to go through. He knows what we're going to go through. He knows what they were going to go through. Again, hammering that point home is that it's not just a book written specifically for a certain group of people. It's written for the benefit of the church as a whole. It seems that he might be encouraging the church by reminding us that he overcame. Okay, now, as I mentioned before, you know, as I was kind of reading through that, why is he naming all this stuff? Why is he reminding them, if this is Jesus, why is he reminding them that he is the one who is dead and alive forevermore? Why is he reminding them that he's the one who has the keys to death and to Hades? Well, probably because there's going to be some things that are going to happen to the church individually and as a body throughout the church age that we're going to need that encouragement. And, you know, yeah, it's easy to remember. You could say it's easy to remember, but like you pointed out this morning, as we meet together and encourage for the Lord's Supper, it's a chance to encourage one another every week. Yeah, you could say, "Oh, yeah, I know that Jesus died for me. I know he rose from the dead." Yeah, and that's true. We can remember that all the time. But it's also, you know, if you ever went through those times that you went through things or tough times, and maybe you forgot some things that you should, after you realize it, or maybe it's pointed out to you through a trial or through something, you're just like, how come I didn't remember this before? So it's something we need to be reminded of. And Jesus, yeah. Did they not know that he resurrected and overcame death and conquered death? Yeah, but maybe they need to be reminded about it, especially if they're staring death in the face as well. And especially if we're going to stare death in the face as well, we might need to be reminded about that. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians 15. So let's notice that in Revelation 1:18, he says that he has the keys to death and to Hades. So I want to read verse 26 of 1 Corinthians 15, please. Okay, so death, you know, we think that, and it is true, Satan, Hebrews 2 referenced that he rendered him powerless who had the power over death, that is the devil. So Jesus did that by his death. He rendered Satan who had power over death. But if you go through, Satan is destroyed first, and death is abolished after. Now, Satan really wouldn't have any power if there wasn't death to start with. Okay? A possibility. And so my point in saying that is that Jesus bypasses even Satan himself and saying, I have the keys. Yes, if he has the keys to the thing that even can doom Satan, then he has the keys over Satan. He controls Satan too. He has the power over him. But he's saying, I have the keys to death and to Hades. And he says the last enemy that's going to be destroyed is death. Okay, the Lord has the power over death and Hades. If he is overcome, then we will also, Philippians 3 talks about that, that Paul talks about that resurrection that he's looking forward to, resurrection of the body. You know, that since Christ overcame, yes, as Christians, we have resurrected spiritually, and that is true. But there's still a resurrection that we still wait. We still are waiting on, and as Paul says in Philippians 3 there, is that I haven't laid hold of it yet. Okay? We haven't laid hold of it yet. We still are looking for that because we still all have to pass through death unless Christ comes before. So he has the keys to death and to Hades. It can be an encouragement. Yeah, we can talk about, yeah, I'm not afraid to die, which I'm not saying that we are. I'm just saying is that death is something that nobody has ever told how it is on the other side of death and come back and told us how it is. So there's going to need to be some encouragement even amongst Christians that, hey, I have the keys to death and of Hades. I have overcome. I have resurrected. And if I resurrect, as Paul was saying there, we can have hope in resurrecting as well. Anybody have any comments on that before we move on? Verse 19. Change something there. Let's just do that. Okay. Okay, so Revelation chapter 1, verse 19. Sorry about the little hiccup there. Someone like to read that, please.
Therefore, write the things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which will take place after these things.
Okay. So here, King Jesus tells John to write about three things. Obviously, there's multiple things, but what I mean by that is there's three groups of things that he tells them to write about. Okay? The first one is the things that he has seen. So this communicates who he is writing to them. A little typo there, I think. The things that he has seen. Okay, so he's communicating who it is that is writing to them. That it's Jesus. Okay, Jesus is the one who is writing to them. He is the one who is giving John the message to write to the church. The church as a whole, but the seven churches specifically. And also, just on a little side note there, when we talk about Jesus and John being before Jesus and talking to Jesus, yes, there's times when there's the angel of the Lord it talks about in the book will communicate something to John. But the angel of the Lord does not communicate those things to John outside of the instruction of the Lord. Okay, so when the angel of the Lord is doing that, it's still Jesus communicating that. And that's not a foreign idea to us, you know, John's writing this, but it's still the Lord's words, okay? But he is writing the things that he has seen, okay? He's going to describe who it is that is writing, that's really writing the message here, and that's Jesus. The second thing he writes about, he says the things that are. Okay, this is the things that are established at John's time. It's talking, so write about things that are happening now in John's time. Okay, so the things that are, the book applied to the first century Christians, yes, as much as it applies to us. So on the one side, we're going to hit that idea that the book is just future and maybe applies to us because everybody you talk to, which I'm not saying that Jesus couldn't come back tomorrow, but a lot of times people talk about, oh, he's going to come back. Well, they've been saying that for a while, and I'm not saying he's not. I'm just saying is that it does apply to us, but it it applies to them. But you'll see, like, the premillennialist theory is that, well, it doesn't apply to the first century. It only applies to the future. And he is saying here, write the things that are. So there's things that are established at John's time that he is writing about, and it applies to the first century Christian. On the flip side of that, he says, write the things that will take place after these things. And that kind of goes against your preterist or postmillennial idea that it doesn't just apply to the first century Christian. So they'll say that as we talked before in our introduction, that the book only applies to the Christians in the first century is what they'll teach. And John is saying that write the things that are going to take place after that, Jesus says. So that is applying to it's not just the first century Christian that it's applying to. So you see that both ways. You have it applies to the first century Christian, and it applies to us today and in the future and everyone in between. And so the book doesn't just apply to a certain few. I mean, and that really doesn't make sense if you look at, I mean, yes, you have your Old Testament stuff that has had stuff that happened in the past. There's stuff in the Old Testament that doesn't apply specifically to us as far as, like, I mean, we're not going through the Exodus. We're not going through the Red Sea. We're not going through what Abraham went through or David went through. Or there's principles in the Old Testament that we need to learn from, yes, and there's scripture in the Old Testament that point to the New Testament, yes. But to say that after the New Covenant, then the New Testament applies to us until Jude, and then the last book only applies to a certain group of people. It doesn't make sense when you think of it that way, when you look at that, because that's, God is looking at something, and he's talking about things clear up until his return, because we read this, we read it before today, but in Revelation 22, is that Jesus said, my reward is with me. So clear up until he rewards the saints. So again, it doesn't just apply to the first century. It doesn't just apply to the last century. It applies to the church as a whole. Oh, there you go. Anybody have any comments on that before we move on? Okay, so verse 20, if someone would like to read that, please. Okay, so Jesus holds the seven stars in his right hand, okay? And it says that the seven stars are angels, okay? The Greek word for angel means, if you look at the meaning, it means angel or messenger, okay? And that doesn't have to be angel. It doesn't have to be translated angel. There's a pretty common passage that we have that we probably quote quite a bit, and people know a lot, that uses this word, and it's not talking about an angel. And let's turn to Matthew chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11. Now, I'm not saying it never talks about an angel. I'm just saying the context can dictate what it's saying there. And we need to understand, sometimes we think of the angel, and we get the picture of the angel and the angels in Ezekiel chapter 1, where they're the glowing with the fire, and they have the wings and the sound like the Almighty, and we think that that's the only time that angel can apply, and that's what it has to mean exactly. But the word can mean messenger. So if someone wants to read Matthew chapter 11, verse 10, please. Okay, so this same Greek word is translated messenger here. And it's talking about John the Immerser. Jesus is talking about John, who is in prison, and he quotes, I believe it's Isaiah there, he quotes that I will send my messenger ahead of you. That word messenger is the same Greek word as John uses in Revelation 1:20 that says that the seven stars are seven angels. And then you go out throughout Revelation 2 and 3, where it says to the angel of the church of Ephesus, to the angel of the church in Smyrna, to the angel in the church of so-and-so. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that it doesn't mean angel at times. I'm just saying it can also mean messenger. And so when we're looking at that, then I think the term could mean messenger, possibly an evangelist of the congregation or somebody who is close there. Because it's specifically writing to the angel at the church in such and such a place, Ephesus, Smyrna. And so it doesn't necessarily fit the context of like a Gabriel or a Michael. Okay? It could mean a messenger. Now again, I'm not saying that if someone came and showed me something different that I would definitely believe that. But I'm saying it doesn't have to mean specifically an angel with wings and the almighty sword of God in his hand and powerful. It can mean a messenger, which in some ways would make sense because he's writing it to the angel to communicate, or I should say, he's writing it to the messenger to communicate to the congregation. Because John still, as referenced before, John is on the island of Patmos in a prison island, really. He can't go and deliver this message to him. So somebody has to. So back to Revelation chapter 20, or one, sorry, 1 verse 20. It references the lampstands. Okay, it says Jesus, if you look in chapter 2 verse 1, he references that he is the one who walks among the seven golden lampstands. Okay, so the lampstands are the churches. Let's turn back to Exodus chapter 25. Exodus 25. Now this is where Moses is given the description of how to build the tabernacle and things for that. And in verse 31, for the sake of time, we're going to kind of skim this here a little bit. But verse 31, if you want to read the passage, read 31 through 40 of Exodus chapter 25. But he says, "You'll make a lampstand of pure gold and hammered work and so on." And then he goes down in verse 37, he says, "You shall make its lamps seven in number." Okay, so there were seven lamps in the tabernacle before the Holy of Holies by the veil. Okay, and in chapter, I think I don't have this passage, but in chapter 26, it mentions that there's one lampstand right by the Holy of Holies with the table and such. But the idea there is that he is making, that's a picture in verse 40 there of Exodus 25, is that, "See that you make them after the pattern which is shown to you on the mountain." So Moses saw a pattern, and God is showing him the picture of the spiritual temple, or the spiritual tabernacle, either one, and he says that the lampstands, he is making the old covenant lampstand, there's seven lamps, and that picture of what the church is going to be. So Jesus, when he's referring to the seven lampstands, and we talked before, there's more than seven churches of Asia, and so these churches were chosen for a reason because of their spiritual condition, to describe and communicate a message to the church as a whole. But the seven lampstands is reference to, hey, these are lamps. This is something that's in the temple of God. So let's turn ahead to the New Testament in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Someone like to read verse 16, please.
"Or what agreement does the temple of God have with idols? For we are the temple of the living God, just as God said, 'I will dwell among them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.'"
Yeah. So Jesus is said in Revelation 1 and 2, he walks among, or he is among, he's in the middle of the seven lampstands. Okay, he walks among them. And the church, as Paul says here, we are the temple of God. And you can cross over the temple, tabernacle was pre-temple when they were moving still and conquering the land. And then after David plans the temple and Solomon builds the temple was a permanent structure, but it still crossed over. It's where the glory of God filled the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle, and the glory of God filled the Holy of Holies in the temple. Okay, so the church is the temple of God, and he walks among them. Okay, Jesus walks among them. Turn back to Matthew 5. Matthew 5, there's a couple more passages here. Verse... So I want to read 14 through 16, please.
"You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven."
Okay, turn to Philippians, chapter 2, verse 15. So Jesus says there in John or in Matthew that we are the light of the world. Philippians chapter 2, verse 15. Someone like to read that, please.
That you may prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God, above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world.
Okay, so this idea of the church being a light, or like a lampstand, is not a foreign idea. Obviously, the lampstands represent the churches, which he says that already. But just as more emphasis, because this is going to come up later in the book again. But it's not going to be detailed as the seven churches. And so when we look at that, we need to know, okay, when John is entered, that's why I've kind of subtitled this section, Introduction of the Book, even though we kind of had the introduction before, but John himself is introducing the book and giving details that we're going to need to know as we study through that later, because he gives details of the lampstands. He gives details of who Jesus is and what he's accomplished. He gives details about the kingdom in chapter 1 as well. And so as we're going through the letters to the seven churches individually there and going through the book as a whole, we have to know some of these things because he's starting off and explaining some of these things. So when we get to the spots where it's more difficult to understand what he's talking about, we can reference is that, oh man, that would be talking about that. Just for one example, I mean, it's not really an example, but if it talks about somebody with a sword coming out of his mouth, who in Revelation 19 is going to say that's not talking about Jesus? So why would we think of something else when it references like lampstands or tabernacles or something that it's not talking about the church? And so we need to understand that as we go through that when that's referenced in that way, okay, we know who that is talking about because we know the description in the introduction here of chapter 1 that John is talking about Jesus or John is talking about the church or John is talking about whatever he's talking about. He's talking about the kingdom or whatnot. So there's details here that we need to know as we continue into the book. And so it's important for us to understand that the church is a lamp. It's also, as we'll see, it's also an olive tree, as described other places. But we'll talk about that another time. But anybody have any comments or questions today's class?
I just think it's kind of incredible when you look at the prophecy and the visions or whatever that these guys have seen. Even from Moses to Ezekiel to Daniel, and then you see John in Revelation. And, you know, every single thing might not be exact word for word, but when you really look at those with an open mind, you see the similarities between all those things. And that's across generation after generation of man, different walks of life, different languages, many different things there, and the similarities are still there. And it really just shows that picture, you know, back at the early tabernacle, you know, a copy of the things, all the way through is the same picture. It's the same plan, and it's not, you know, it's not this is just for these people and this is just for these people, but you got to look at it as the whole and, you know, as God's kingdom and the plan there. And it's really incredible that any of that stuff can match up. Right. But it matches up a lot closer than you really think if you pay attention to it, I think. So it's pretty incredible. And those pictures, like, you know, like John is giving here or Ezekiel's giving, I mean, they're things that we have a hard time wrapping our mind around because it's, you know, what's this wheel covered with eyes? And it's, you know, things are not of this world, but that's because they're not of this world.
Right.
And they're just trying to give that description of what they see. And and if there's ever a time where, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words, you know, these guys are looking at it.
And like you say, there is, because you could go ahead and not a lot of people do this, but there's, you could say in Ezekiel, the cherubim have four wings, but in Isaiah, they have six, you know, and so you could say, well, that doesn't really line up. Well, that's not the point. It's, I mean, we look at, well, has every little letter in detail has to line up, and I'm not saying that there's not time for that, like you say, but when it's obvious that Isaiah is describing cherubim and the throne of God there in Isaiah 6, but it's also pretty obvious that Ezekiel is given that description too. And so when they're doing that, even though that the Ezekiel's vision didn't line up exactly with Isaiah's vision or with Daniel's vision or with Zechariah's or whoever else, I mean, there's enough things there that cross over that God is really speaking in that way. And as we mentioned before, it shouldn't surprise us because God has multiple names. He's communicating something by his names, whether it's Great Physician, Good Shepherd, Mighty God. It's not uncommon for God to describe his character in multiple different ways. How could you be a lion but also be a lamb? Well, he's describing his character. And so it shouldn't derail us when we have these little things here. Those are little things. God is communicating the big picture to us that, hey, this is me glorified, and this is who's communicating to you. And all of these messages, all these visions in the Old Covenant were summed up in Christ in the revelation of Jesus Christ here under the New Covenant, because he's glorified. Any other comments? Thanks. Okay, we'll stop there today and pick up with the letters next week.